that I will draw on. It occurred to me that I have apparently been attempting to plow somewhat similar ground to resolve some of these connections and possible contradictions. We will begin with Larry Rigby, and I'll turn the mic over to him.
Thank you, Paul. Just to sort of set up the parts of the book that I'm going to read, let me just give you a little bit of background for those who haven't read the book. It's about a character who is a baby boomer in his late 50s who succeeds with the American dream and becomes quite wealthy. And he retires to pursue his passion, which is painting. And he looks to Germany, to Berlin, where there's a very hot art market and a lot of new ideas circulating. And he wants to go there on a kind of sabbatical from his family to learn how to paint. And in the process, he meets a character who's sort of like Mephistopheles in Goethe's Faust, who becomes his promoter and also the agent for his downfall. And this Mephistopheles is a very erudite and very sophisticated person who keys in very quickly on the two elements that are really Preston Wright, and that's the name of the character. They are his most vulnerable weaknesses, and he keys in on those very quickly. And I'm going to read some parts to start with that are essentially a dialogue between Mephistopheles and Preston Wright. The first one, his name is Malik. Malik continues in his declaiming tone. Your countrymen are always seeking justice in the courts, but really there is very little justice on this earth. If I had my way, this world wouldn't be in such a mess. The injustice is terrible, only a phantom of justice. Every day people take their grievances to court, and every day verdicts against the victims are handed down. Why? Because of money. Money buys the best attorneys, depositions, testimonies of expert witnesses, the best evidence. Money buys verdicts. The rich win and the poor lose. Well, that's a pretty jaded view, but I suppose you're right. There are many instances of stolen justice. Take your Porsche, for example, stolen in broad daylight 30 minutes after you had parked it. There is no justice with that. The police can't even find a trace of it or the thieves, and they never will. You won't ever retrieve that, ever. How the hell does he know that? I'm afraid you're right, they never will, and I hadn't secured insurance for it, so it's a total loss, more than $90,000. A sinister glint of contempt flashes in Malik's eyes. And being a good church-going Christian, you are probably inclined to forgive the insolent, petty clowns who took it and have been taught one of the greatest untruths, to turn the other cheek. It runs counter to nature and evolution itself. But I say one of the greatest virtues is knowing when not to forgive. Man's greatest achievements are based on looking out for number one. Preston thinks, I'm warming to this idea. Malik continues his anti-Christian homily. Forgiveness gets one nowhere fast. Mindless forgiveness is for the weakest of the weak. However, we can create our own little instances of justice. You know, and we don't get it by forgiving. I'm not sure I understand where you're headed. Next week I will demonstrate this to you. I'll let you know when and where, perhaps around midnight. Drive your car because the U-Bahn will be closed when you return home. Wear a dark coat. I'll show you some justice. Okay. Meanwhile, let's forget your little Porsche tragedy for a moment and focus on your art again. I have a television interview scheduled for you. An interview? But don't worry. Worry makes you weak. It will be a little dialogue with a man who covers art and culture for Berlin Brandenburg Rundfunk. When? Next Wednesday morning at 11. I will give directions at the UDK. Okay. Here's a later section. Malik rings Preston's cell phone. So, is not my Ivory Helen of Russia the absolute best of the white people? Are you ready to rock and roll, as you Amerikanskis like to say? I agree, she's very white. She possesses the most beautiful whiteness I've seen in many years. Indescribable, she's interesting too, perky. We had a nice talk. Are you prepared to experience the salt and the pepper together? In a couple of weeks, I can arrange a future rendezvous, a supersized one, as you Amerikanskis like everything. Just think about it. The two of them, lithe and youthful, together with you, playing, working you over, frolicking, joking, laughing, groaning, moaning, a scene right out of a Pompeian fresco. Such an intensity of pleasure would be a sin, would be at least for the old chained Preston. But for you now you are getting what you have deserved all along, thanks to having met one named Malik. Is it not Malik who has mentored you, taught you to take advantage of the opportunities your wealth and power have provided you? A means to sexual health, to satisfy your natural reproductive drive. Become as the gods. Acquire some knowledge and experience. Carpe diem, make love, enjoy your new status and the beauty of youth. Luxuriate in the blessings of Venus, for time is short and beauty fades, especially of your cosmetic surgery type. Malik, you're full of crap, excuse the expression. You're sounding like a nagging wife. Desire of this kind needs to be shunned. It can only lead to suffering and pain. Malik continues in his voice of imperative locution, as if Preston had said nothing. The way to solve the problem of desire is to satisfy it. If you do not, other problems pop up, like repression, regret, and the pain of unfulfillment. Just think of it. Sex is the most valuable currency in a barter economy of the sexes. Currency that women at a young age learn to spend to their great advantage in the brutal world of us men. Think about it. Sex is the most powerful weapon, the neutron bomb in the war between the sexes. Therefore, women are the currency of success. It's not the money we fight over, really, nicht wahr? It's the women, then we really think about it. It was a fight over Helen of Troy that caused the Peloponnesian War, you will recall, I'm sure. The best most average schmucks can hope for is a faithful wife along with an occasional ugly whore. But look at you. You are rich, powerful, a successful artist, a man with the benefits of liposuction. You still have your hair, a bit gray, but it is hair. You are one in hundreds of thousands. You can hope for the very best, demand the very best, deserve the very best, access to the most beautiful women, adoring maidens that would do anything to please you. Malik, you're worse than an insurance salesman with garlic breath. And he thinks, sulfur? What point are you trying to make here? What point? After all this, you've missed the point. The point is, my dear Dr. Wright, reap your rewards, grasp them, enjoy them for hell's sake. You can take Cat along now or wait until Newbie is freed up and enjoy them both together. I'll think about that. Thank you.
Well, while we think about that, I'm not going to say anything quite that spicy. Thanks to Paul for putting this session together and inviting us to be part of it. He didn't introduce himself, so I'm going to say a couple words about Paul Swenson. If you haven't read his book of poetry published by Signature Press, it's an extraordinary book of poetry. Take a look. I always get the title wrong. Chilled at the Ward, Burned at the Stake? Oh, Iced at the Ward, Burned at the Stake. Incredible book. He's a marvelous editor. I worked for him when he was one of the editors for the Salt Lake Observer, now defunct. It's a wonderful newspaper, and he's just a fine editor, has a history of that. If you heard Brian Evanson speak this morning, it was an extraordinary expression of life's work and history at BYU and decisions and that sort of thing. My presentation today will basically end where his started. So this is a manuscript that's being written probably just to help me define my life and figure out who I am and think through who our family is. We understand what we do and have context for what we do because we tell stories. And we have memories and we repeat the memories and repeat the stories. And so that's why I keep working at this. This is the epilogue. 23rd of September, 1995, Salt Lake City. The family, a proclamation to the world. We, the First Presidency, and the Council of the 12 Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, solemnly proclaim that marriage between a man and a woman is ordained of God, and that the family is central to the Creator's plan for the eternal destiny of His children. All human beings, male and female, are created in the image of God. Each is a beloved spirit, son or daughter of heavenly parents, and as such, each has a divine nature and destiny. Gender is an essential characteristic of individual, premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose. We further declare that God has commanded that the sacred powers of procreation are to be employed only between man and woman, lawfully wedded, as husband and wife. We warn that the disintegration of the family will bring upon individuals, communities, and nations the calamities foretold by ancient and modern prophets. We call upon responsible citizens and officers of government everywhere to promote those measures designed to maintain and strengthen the family as the fundamental unit of society. That you cite the proclamation as the first entry in your epilogue gives it the force it deserves. Since the 1987 revelation reversing over a century of official LDS discrimination against men of African descent, the First Presidency's focus on heterosexual marriages and condemnation of homosexuality is its most far-reaching doctrinal statement. It contrasts so starkly with the ideas and feelings you have expressed here that I predict difficult decisions for you in the near future. I wish you well. 30th of October, 1996, LDS Church, Orem. A Cub Scout pack meeting in the church gymnasium. The boys and their den mothers are dressed up in costumes for Halloween. Bishop Gunderson, wearing a trim scout uniform, announces that we should rise for the presenting of the colors. We stand. Bishop Gunderson salutes smartly while the rest of us place our hands over our hearts. The first boy in the color guard wears a blue and gold Cub Scout uniform. The third boy is dressed like a bloody but elegant vampire. Marching between the Cub Scout and the vampire, carrying the flag, is my son Sam, in the dress and wig Benjamin wore last year. There are scattered chuckles as Sam levers the flag into the heavy brass stand. "I pledge allegiance," the vampire begins. Sam rips the wig from his head and holds it over his heart to the flag of the United States of America. 3rd of January, 1997, Orem. Actually, I'm going to skip that. 16th of June, 1998, Provo. Today I received a copy of the AAUP report written after the investigation into violations of academic freedom from BYU. Reading this carefully scathing account, I remember the moment I escorted BYU President Merrill Bateman and two of his dark-suited male assistants out of the room where they had met with the AAUP investigators for over an hour. Glancing back through the door, I caught the eye of the committee chair, head of the English department at Nebraska. She smiled and rolled her eyes back into her head. Here's a quotation from that report from the AAUP. The report of the investigating committee describes the rejection of the candidacy of an assistant professor of English for tenure and promotion. The university faculty council did not quarrel with the assessments of her research and teaching, but it recommended against tenure and promotion on grounds that her actions and words were contrary to the tenets of the Mormon Church and harmful to Brigham Young University. We feel, the council member stated, that not only have these activities failed to strengthen the moral vigor of the university, they have enervated its very fiber. She was accused specifically of disregarding the university's stated limitations on academic freedom by publicly contradicting church doctrine and deliberately attacking church leadership, particularly through public statements supporting the practice of praying to Heavenly Mother as well as Heavenly Father. The investigating committee concluded that the stated limitations on academic freedom at BYU provide inadequate guidance to faculty members and give excessive discretion to the administration. They also concluded that the administration, to the extent that it rejected the assistant professor's candidacy because of displeasure with the positions on feminism she took in her teaching and scholarly work, violated her academic freedom. Finally, citing several other cases and an array of complaints that have been brought to the investigating committee's attention, this included David Knowlton's case, he's in the audience today, the committee concluded that at BYU, infringements on academic freedom are distressingly common, and the climate for academic freedom is distressingly poor. 23rd of May, 1998, Belgrade. Where to begin this story of a trip along the Drina River after the war with Žarko Radakovic, Zlatko Bokokic, and Peter Handke? Let it begin as a family story, perhaps, in 1998, in Belgrade, among the well-kept ruins of the Kalemegdan fortress that overlooks the confluence of the Sava and Danube rivers. A barrel-chested man walks along a path with his two little girls. They lag behind. He shouts at them. They catch up. They turn aside to play among wildflowers. He threatens them. The girls join him momentarily, then disappear among the tall flowers. He roars a command. They return. The youngest one begins to cry. The older girl takes her hand. The big man steps off the path. He rips a bunch of wildflowers from the high grass. He hands them to the crying girl. She stops crying. He shouts again. They walk away, all three of them, holding mismatched hands. 22nd of May, 1998, Belgrade. Žarko's mother, Ljubica, is 72 years old and not at all well. She refuses, however, to go to a doctor. At my age, she explains to her interpreter son, it's better to steer clear of potential disaster. Her hands turn and weigh and rub a cigarette holder and lighter. She smokes Partners, a brand she says comes from Macedonia. With the cigarette holder between long fingers, she reminds me of Greta Garbo. She snuggles up to Žarko, smooths his hair, and asks, what barbarian cut your hair? She complains she has but a single grandchild. Žarko tells her, I have seven children. She nods her head approvingly. My son, she says, pointing her cigarette at Jarko, is lazy, just one. I picture Joe and Marin and Tom and Nate and Ben and Sam and Tim. How might they deal with a breakup of a 25-year marriage? The TV flickers interminably. A news report shows students demonstrating at the university against newly announced education reforms. May 25th, 1998, Belgrade. Ljubica Radaković feeds us chicken soup, then new potatoes and carrots and chicken with gravy. While we eat, she smokes. You remind me of Greta Garbo, I tell her. Jarko translates. She shakes her head and says, Greta Garbo with diabetes. A parliamentary debate on the education reform law flickers silently on the TV while we eat. If the reform passes, Jarko explains, university deans will be appointed by the Minister of Education. Faculty appointments will require ministerial approval, and all faculty members will have to sign new contracts affirming their support for the new policies. That's how they do it where I work, I tell him. Not a healthy system unless your main concern is to preserve an established way of thinking. I wouldn't recommend it. Ljubica, who has returned to her native Serbian Orthodoxy, is surprised to learn that I work for a church university. It's an odd fit, I explain. I grew up Mormon. I served as a Mormon missionary. I have a Mormon marriage. I raised my children to be Mormons. But over the years, I've lost my faith. I'm no longer a believer. What should I do? Leave my job? Leave my marriage? Abandon my people? No. No, Ljubica says. Be careful. Move slowly. Doviđenja, I say as we leave. Ljubica beams and waves her momentarily empty cigarette holder. 29th of May, 1998, Visegrad, Republika Srpska. Was denkt in dir, Peter asks. What? What? I ask, unable to hear him over the news of, over the noise of Milke and her band. What is thinking in you? Sorrow, I answer. In 1992, there was intense fighting here. Marauding Muslims, marauding Serbs, and the town is now devoid of Muslims. There remain only the roofless, windowless brick shells of their houses. Since we crossed into the border, into the Republika Srpska, I have been imagining Muslims and Serbs lying in bed during the unrest, worrying as they lay there about possible futures, about a sudden end to possible futures. 14th of June, 1998, Provo, Utah. Dear Jarko, I taught my church class today. The younger brothers and sisters of the children in the class you visited 4 years ago. Do you remember? Because of the changes in the church and at the university, I am now forced to teach this class. I taught so willingly for so long. The assigned lesson was about Joshua and the Battle of Jericho. I remember the story from my own childhood Sunday school. The part about the circling army and the shouts that caused the city's wall to fall down. What I didn't remember was God's command that Joshua and his army fulfilled as, quote, they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword. Joshua went on to the city of Ai, all of whose inhabitants he killed, men and women. And then he burned it and made it an heap forever, even a desolation unto this day. Next was the city of Hazor. There was not any left to breathe, and he burnt Hazor with fire. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord said unto Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land rested from war. The lesson manual suggested that I emphasize how the Lord blesses those who follow his orders exactly. After our trip, that was impossible. After our trip, many things will be impossible. 2nd of June, 1999, Provo. Dear Jarko, John's birthday tomorrow. Had he not contracted AIDS, he would have been 49. As you know, John's death loosed some of my moorings, undermined some of my certainties, stimulated new certainties. Our trip along the Drina River was a similar experience for me. I'm not the same person I was before traveling in your suddenly divided country. Yesterday I signed papers resigning from Brigham Young University. For 11 years I worked for an increasingly coercive and distrustful organization, for a church that hated my brother and his kind. As the regulations for continuing employment grew more severe, I found ways to subvert requirements I had willingly complied with for years. Forced to pay tithing to 10% of my earnings, I quit paying all but a token. Forced to comply with dietary laws I had obeyed all my life, I began to imbibe. Forced to state my allegiance, I decided I had no allegiance. This fall, I'll be a professor of philosophy and humanities at Utah Valley State College, another step toward a life I can construct on my own terms. Yes, I remember Herder's dictum that we don't speak language, but that it speaks us. I'm going to look for my own terms anyway. 21st of March, 2000, Provo. Our divorce became final today in the wooden language of the law. It is hereby ordered, adjudged, and decreed. The bonds of matrimony and the marriage contract heretofore existing by and between the petitioner and respondent be and the same are hereby dissolved, and the petitioner is hereby awarded a decree of divorce from defendant on the grounds of irreconcilable differences. If I were the author of state law, I'd write an alternative text. One that petitioners could choose if they so wished. After 25 years of marriage, remembering the richness and even splendor of shared experiences, mindful of their 7 wonderful children, regretting sometimes bitter incompatibilities, these two human beings part ways. 20th of November, 2002, Provo, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Membership Records Department, 50 East North Temple, Salt Lake, Utah, 84111, to whom it may concern. Would you please remove my name from the records of your church? The critical issues that make me unwilling to remain a member of the Mormon Church are the church's focus on obedience to patriarchal authority, where reasoned discussion would be more productive, and the church's support of laws to limit the rights of gays and lesbians. The letter was straightforward enough. It was more difficult to explain the decision to my children, several of whom are still active in the religion I helped them learn. I don't believe I've found the one truth, I told them. But the church that was so much a part of my life for half a century isn't good for me any longer. My choice is based on what I think are good reasons. You'll each have a lifetime to decide what's good for you. 26th of December, 2003, Provo. Christmas packages from Tom and Nate. From Brooklyn, Tom sent a CD of his Henry Jones Swing Trio. I've been listening to his long, sweet clarinet improvisations for hours. Nate sent a deft sketch of a Hong Kong bridge along with a lively description of an old man he was trying to proselytize. I had sent him Ed Abbey's response to a missionary, "So you're going to Christianize the savages? Aren't they savage enough already?" Nate's reply, "Dad, I love you." Ben and Sam and Tim joined Lynn and me for Christmas dinner. She prepared a vegetarian feast that made us forget the taste of ham. The boys seem to be adjusting well enough to the divorce. Who knows what lurks beneath? And have responded generously to the idea of their father with a new partner. Marin and Brandon brought Kylie and Caden to see their grandfather, and later Joe and Tracy stopped by with little Jake, adopted in November. Nothing stands still for us. Feels good, mostly.
Tough acts to follow. So as we see, there are all kinds of violence, including psychological violence. And you know, we sometimes think of sex and violence as those things that determine ratings of movies, and think of them in those terms. How they operate in our own lives is something we may not talk about all that often or discuss. And violence is certainly not a proclivity only of males. We all have instincts that we deal with. I'm going to read you a few poems that possibly reflect on these subjects. I've been flirting with the idea of moving from behind the podium and speaking from that microphone. I'm starting here. I may proceed to do that. Back here, to some degree, I feel trapped. You're out there. I'm here. So, if I walk out to meet you, don't be afraid. I'll keep my distance to some degree. But so I'm going to read you a poem called "In the Beginning." In the beginning, nobody thought about an end, since everything was new, and true was plain as blue sky or cry of baby who didn't know clothes or what it meant to wear them. Life was plain as nose on baby face, and fresh air sucked through it was sweet and true. When eyes opened, it would be forever before someone remembered they could also close. Heart had started, and that part of the brain that would feel pain was green and inexperienced. In the beginning, we were clean. Shame accumulated layer by layer before we noticed we were dressed in it, or that the name that we were blessed with no longer sounded like a prayer. Became players in life's game, wore the uniform of normal, a suit, a smile, combat boots, a gun. It would take a while, but we would claim to learn that freedom isn't free, and that we needn't turn a cheek to latent enemy, since first strikes compulsory and could be fun if clothed in power suit of number one. Fortunate we had scruples against torture. Idealistically would nurture world's pupils in democracy, humane treatment of the captives euphemistically we called detainees. But surely we could justify a little pain, a prod to tease the information we required and expose the sham religion of a bogus god. Strange that after we had stripped the prisoner, deprived him of his sleep and dignity, some aspect of his vulnerability was similar to you and me in the beginning. Proceeding with a possible political tone, this is a poem called "Blue in a Red State." Grew up in Red Rock Country. Watched red-blooded males stalk red-tailed deer. At 12, helped my in-law brother drag a carcass to the highway. For a year, we dined on venison. True wild red meat seemed fine to me. Strange, that day, gunmetal gray still leaves me blue. At school, they called Joe Hill a red, but he wrote protest blues for working folk, fused with passions of Salvation Army lasses that he stole his tunes from. When scabs broke the strikes he organized, said he wouldn't be caught dead in Utah. Surprised by bullets from a firing squad at Sugar House, and bled to death. Amid red sea of true believers, few of us still flicker nonconformist blue. Cringe with irony when family values radio inveighs against the fringe, peaceniks, gays, and immigrants. How sure are summer patriots that war is valuable? One needn't be well-read to know the poor, to count the dead. Blue sky stretches from Bear Lake to Zion, cedar to canyon lands. Rosy band of color in the west, 50s flashback, false sunrise of atomic tests. If God allotted stewardship for deserts, red and waters blue, is there time to learn respect for animals, the earth, each other, before we burn our mother?
Well, I notice... I think this is working, yes. I notice this is pretty heavy stuff so far. I hope there's something in here a little lighter. We'll get to it. We'll get to it. However, the next poem is called Violence, Adult Content. Do we still believe in the apocalypse? Not a laugh to think that on a quiet autumn afternoon between lethargic sips of decaf latte, fire may fall from heaven. Surreal and showy to assume that as a gloss on prophecy, Zion's gutters soon will flow with blood instead of mountain water. Who are the dead along the highway? Seen with naked eye, it's tricky to dismiss anachronistic images, dark horse, pale rider. A shock to see since bridal trails engorged to interstate. Is it too late to notice that a yellow dog cannot be found to wag its tail? In blessed sunlight of the new millennium, disciples of the fateful age engage our dread to catalog calamities in store and count the coming dead. Close the shutters, stay indoors, but don't expect protection from foreboding in your dreams or from scenes of carnage on the TV screen. What can it mean to worship a forgiving God? When Jesus walked and spoke to sinners, prostitutes, the lame, he promised mercy to the merciful, the same to those who mourn, the meek, the poor in spirit. Pure in heart, he said that those who seek shall find. Odd that we may awkwardly recall yet fail to recognize the jealous God of wrath who trod a bitter winepress of destruction of the wicked in the Testament of old. We're told the deity who authorized slaughter of whole cities, not a pretty sight, became the shepherd of one fold. And if he comes again at end of days, thief in the night, some say that we should see his crimson raiment of the wine vat as symbol of his majesty. Not me. I choose the Gospel of St. John, whose Lord is one of grace and mystery. Okay, let's see what we can get to here. Okay, I'll pull this one up, which you may or may not find funny. I don't know what you'll think of it. It's called The World of Bad Taste. An itch for kitsch makes me wish Rod McCune would soon reincarnate as hip-hop tunesmith and hope as well another crop of American pop idols bursts the TV screen to crest a tidal wave of mediocrity. Through our tears that Sonny Bono abandoned Cher and showbiz to run for Congress with the GOP, strapped on skis and hit a tree, give thanks for Britney Spears. The dears who didn't notice Cher could act or sing were gluttons for a belly button thing. So raise belated praise to Spears, who perpetuates the craze to navel gaze. Ponder if the secret heart of Gail Ruzicka palpitates or flutters with unseemly longing for the rosy cheeks or other parts of Senator Chris Butters. While it may not keep their fertile minds from occupying public gutters, perhaps we shouldn't look askance or scorn their better natures when at the legislature one detects insinuation of romance in cozy chats adrift the cloakrooms, coats and hats. Admit another passion, maneuver Darwin out of fashion, resist the lure of science, declare an ardent non-compliance with any gay and straight alliance. Should we pity Justin Timberlake, whose unrequited ache for fame amid the halftime stupor of the Super Bowl came off as lame? Although the charmer lacked the least compunction to fake a rape on national TV, failed to attract the surge of media action that Janet Jackson's breast received. How wretchedly he botched his moment to exploit the Cyclops' eye of cheap celebrity. But give the guy a break. His unction was extreme. Still loiters in the shadows of the decade's tawdriest euphemism, wardrobe malfunction. Hail to Larry Miller. Auto dealer, movie magnate, restaurateur, philanthropist, and sports entrepreneur. Killer, Miller kissed box office bucks goodbye for principle. At the Megaplex, would not acquiesce that any other kind but heterosex exists. His scruples were invincible. Try this deal. Drive south to Sandy, hit the Miller Complex for a movie and a meal. You know this guy. Taste is in his mouth. So at the Mayan, if your film was hostile, go heavy on the vino, chase the blood, dismemberment, and Quentin Tarantino. While Brokeback Mountain was not allowed to play there, playing there was a film called Hostel, produced by Tarantino, not directed, which featured pretty grotesque stuff. Okay, I'm going to read you a couple more. This is called Stare Decisis. I think in an earlier session here at Sunstone, somebody did the etymology of the word starry, and as much as I wish that it had anything to do with the stars, it doesn't. It means to stand, I believe. But I didn't know that at the time I wrote the poem. If you remember the Supreme Court deliberations before the two new justices were put in place, stare decisis was a phrase that came into play heavily. Stare decisis. Crisis in the law that if decision a priori circumscribes a flaw as precedent, the court of last resort is hesitant to agitate the gods for change. Ice in the veins of science solidifies our vain reliance on the shibboleth. Experiment can do no harm. Split the atom, drop the bomb. Isis, goddess of fertility and motherhood, would toss her cookies should she look too closely at competing notions that the uterus is public property or worse, a useless curse. Nice, as biblical tradition is, to first insist we love the sinner, then refer us to Leviticus. Perhaps it's time to make a fuss, since stones intended for unnaturals are also meant for us. Thrice divisive in law, in science, in faith, is seen as failure to cooperate. Is admitting that you don't know all the answers indecisive? Latin lied, we and not the stars decide. Okay, I'm going to end with this one, and I will warn you ahead of time, it has language that you may find difficult. Hopefully to some purpose, however. And the poem is called Sex as Subtext. In the lexicon of sex are words of love a cover for hostility? Or do the lovers choose to render Anglo-Saxon crudities as bliss? Kiss my ass, or kiss my ass. Does the lowest insult conceal the tender and the real? In the nude, it's hard to tell what's ardent and what's crude. Screw you. It's uttered as a threat, but in unconscious hunger for the glide and sweat of love, you may be sure it's often longing camouflaged as slur. I suck, you suck, we suck. No longer babies, we spit it out as if the verb were nasty to the taste. Don't waste the tang of sensual pleasure. Savor it. Antagonistic prig invented motherfucker as vicious, dirty dig, but could not glom on the link between his mom, his miserable existence, sex, his ex. Movie romance has evolved from embarrassment for intimacy to sleeping with the enemy. In taking off the gloves, we bare our knuckles, or we love. Thank you.
I think what we're going to do now, can someone tell me the time at the moment, since I'm not wearing a watch?
10 after 12.
Okay.
The legal time is 12:07.
We want the legal time. Yes, we do. So what I thought we'd do now is possibly pass the microphone between the three of us, chat a bit about the implications of what you've heard, and then open things up to you to engage with us, ask us questions, and confront us in any way you might see as important. So how to frame this? How do we deal with religion, sex, and violence all under the same tent, human emotion, male, the way males are thought to think about these subjects? How do we deal with it in literature? How do we define ourselves in terms of what masculinity means by the works we attempt to project when we write literature? That's a wide open gate. I don't know where we'll take it from there, but
I just want to say I'm shocked, Paul, by your language. And Dennis Potter, who's in the back there, showed South Park. It had the episode about Mormons. It had nothing like what you do. Is this a first for a Sunstone session?
Cliff and Jolly.
So you're following a good lead.
Well, Paul's poems
really sort of capture an essence of these themes that he's struck in this part of the symposium. You know, I think if one looks at masculinity, the worst elements of masculinity are basically perpetrated by males in the sense of the stereotype of the male. The stereotype of the male, if you're with a group of rowdy men, they are propagating and infusing this stereotype with energy a lot of the time. For example, in my book, there's a hunting scene where all the men are gathered before the elk hunt, and the bantering that goes on in that dialogue between the men is out of my reality. And I think it's something that you would never see this sort of exchange between women and men, or among women alone. It serves to propagate this kind of stereotypic image of what real masculinity is, what, you know, testosterone-driven masculinity might be, I tried to bring that out a little bit in my book as well, that masculinity is not going to change that much, I think, the notion of masculinity, the definition of it, goes back ages and it's still there embedded in among the male minds. So that's one point that I wanted to lead out.
I had a question for Larry. I read this book a month ago, The Jaeger Artist, and it sucked me right through. I mean, it's a real page-turner, bodice-ripper. I'm not sure about the bodice-ripping. There's lots about you in this. I mean, I don't know you, but in the back there's or somewhere on your website there's a description of your own life history that's not fictional, and so like the character in this, you studied German literature, and like the character in this, you retired from a business career to be a painter, and like the character, all kinds of things, but you just read us this wild passage of sex with a black and white slave, young slave, and I'm not going to ask you if it's all autobiographical or not. But what I'm getting to is a question about what you learned about yourself writing the novel.
Well, I think writing, you always do learn a little bit about yourself because you plumb yourself. I mean, you write out of your own reality, you know, this the people who know me, who've read this book, believe that this is some kind of mutation of Larry Rigby that has just gone terribly amok, and I wrote it with the idea that it would go, that this character would go terribly amok, and I hope interestingly amok. So, I think there is an element of self-discovery. I mean, your work, obviously, is much more introspective on the surface than mine would be. But underneath fiction, in between the lines and in the back, behind the veil, is always the experience of the author and his imagined world to a certain extent. So, I mean... it is a book about me, but it is not a book about me. You know, it comes out of my reality, but it's about a character. You know, I couldn't write about myself because I'm not interesting, but the character Preston Wright is, I think, tried to make him an interesting character. Paul?
Well, if you create that kind of a character, you don't do that out of thin air, so...
That came out of something in you, Larry, that I think is, yeah, interesting, I would say. But I want to ask Scott. Scott's memoir, part of what it does is explore his relationship to his brother who died of AIDS, and to his own masculinity, and to who Scott is as a person. And he goes in search, you know, he goes in search of a relationship with his brother that he perhaps wished he would have had more deeply while he was alive, and in process finds out things about himself. And what did you learn in that search, Scott?
I can't answer that very well. Let me tell a story in response. You know the documentary film that was just made about Mormons? They came to Salt Lake and invited lots of people in and did lots of filming.
Has it been shown yet?
No. But some of you know that it was made. And the writer for that film asked to see this manuscript, and I sent it to her. And then when they were in town, we had dinner one night, and we talked about it. And she said, "So is this manuscript your coming out?" And I said, "Well, in a broad sense, it is." But she said, "No, I mean in that very specific sense, is this your coming out as homosexual?" And I said, "But I'm not homosexual." And one of the interesting things I learned writing this is that as you try to enter other areas of thinking and other ways of feeling, and as you try to feel things that your brother felt and that metaphorically your brothers feel, it puts you in a place where a reader then starts to question your sexuality. And in fact, I tried very carefully to think through who I am sexually. I learned lots writing about my own sexuality. And if I come finally to think, well, I'm heterosexual after all, despite those fears and things I learned in junior high and those kinds of things, well, that's no great triumph. It's just the... It's just who I am biologically. So there's this odd irony that as you question things that you're most afraid of in your own self, you come then to certainties that that are beyond that questioning. So that's I don't know.
Yes, please. I think I really like all of you men on this board or this table, so I want to ask you a question just about gender or manhood or just that. And I'm wondering if is there an attempt in our age to become, as a man, an officiator of fair play and level-headedness and maybe even low burn? I mean, pilot light goes lower and lower, I think, in heroics when we find that if you take steroids and there are no heroes in sports even, that there's, you know, where's testosterone these days? And I'm just wondering if you guys have comments to make just about manhood, because I think that we're on this earth, if we think of God as our officiator on earth, he hasn't put us on an earth of fair play and doesn't expect it. I mean, there's no fair play going on. It's been said that in the Israeli offensive around their borders, they are not going to be led to the slaughter like sheep again. They are going to fight for home or fight for belief. And in our world, certainly in the United States, we're a fair play place, but is that how we experience ourselves and our breadth of humanity? What do you think, guys?
Wow, what a provocative question. Well, we as Americans, as purveyors of fair play, in the past few years, for me, that has been drawn into serious question when we proclaim that we do not torture, we do not, this is something the enemy does, and yet then when we find out that maybe people in our name have tortured, we say, well, we really wasn't much. Think of how badly they treated our people. Well, yeah, that's sort of the point in a way. It's like if we're going to proclaim democratic values as being our guiding star, and we know that our people have been captured in wartime and subjected to incredible indignities, are we going to become like our enemies by taking up means of obtaining information or of showing our superiority that will essentially erase the differences we think we have with people we think of as enemies? Fair play. You're right. Fair play. Is it part of masculinity to try to find some sense of justice and fair play? I hope so, but it's part of humanity, and we probably all ought to be working for that.
Well, I think that life and the world is confusing, and there is always human tension, and there always will be. I think that the idea of the ends justifying the means is sort of the way that politics in the world works, and in a way it is a sort of faint justification for the hypocrisy that we all see. And it's almost impossible not to pursue that sort of politics. And it's almost impossible not to pursue that as a male in the world today. I mean, it's very, very difficult to achieve, for example, a very, very successful business career without really looking out for number one along the way. I mean, there are books on business ethics that would have you believe that one could be very, very Christian and deferring from yourself. But, you know, in the background, if you're going to succeed in business, you really have to look out for number one, and you have to position yourself and so forth and so on. And you're constantly thinking about that. Otherwise, you really don't get very far. I mean, that may be a sort of a cynical view of the world, but I think that getting to your point about masculinity in the world relative to politics, and I'm bringing in the element of business as well, the ends justifying the means is very, very frequently invoked. In order to make, and sometimes that's just there to deal with the basic underlying fear, the emotion of fear that we have.
And even historically God.
Yeah.
I guess that was really what I was thinking about. It seems historically Christian and historically godlike. That the ends do justify the means in so many instances of painful, hurtful tension, as you were bringing up, tension, and life has tension. And you're just wanted to know your opinions on manhood tension.
I thought it was really sweet that you said you liked all three of us. And the second thing I want to say is you just have to be really stupid to take steroids because it shrinks your testicles. And the third thing I'd like to say is, if Dennis Potter is cross-dressing to teach his class, Judith Butler, it's uncomfortable to stand next to him at the urinal.
Well, see, now we're getting down to the real stuff. It took a while, but Mr. Pace.
I'm going to turn this around, this conversation. No. I was just wondering, what is good about masculinity? I mean, nobody ever talks about that. And I feel like in a Mormon society, you know, there's all this talk about a patriarchal society that the Mormons perpetuate. But I think the problem is that, especially in terms of sexuality, I think men in the Mormon church are expected to align themselves with a Victorian feminine notion of sexuality. There is no room for a Mormon sexual man. And I'd like you to address that. Because I think that in literature and in my own work, that's core to it. It's like, and I know that that runs counter to the feminist dogma, but I really would like you to address that. There is no room for a sexual Mormon man, as far as I'm concerned.
How can you look at
it? Doesn't exist.
How can you look at the three of us and say that? Well, no, he's raising some very provocative questions. Well, I want to go back to definitions of masculinity. So was Jesus masculine? Was Jesus sexual? I wrote a poem about that, but that's another story. But masculinity, so Jesus, who spent a whole bunch of time with women and children, seemed very comfortable with them, challenged males of his age that he found hypocritical, threw them into outrage at times because he wouldn't play their game. It raises whole questions of what exactly is masculinity, how narrowly or broadly can it be defined. The idea that I'm often tickled by the idea that male testicles, since you brought them up, are the so.
Female testicles?
Exactly. Wait a minute. What did he mean by that? That courage is centered in your genitals, male genitals, of course. You heard the phrase, boy, he certainly has brass ones or whatever. All of that stuff suggests that standing up, being heroic, being courageous, has something to do with whether you have male genitals or not. I've always found that kind of peculiar. I don't know if it comes from there to be courageous, so, or to be masculine for that matter. What am I saying? I'm not quite sure what I'm saying, but I'm exploring what I think. So I have a wider definition of masculinity, and it doesn't, you know, the macho description of masculinity is one kind of masculinity, but there are a whole bunch of other kinds.
Well, speaking of testosterone and the male sex organ, in my career as a pharmaceutical executive, I flirted for a time with developing a testosterone patch. And hypergonadism or low testosterone is a frequent problem among men, especially as they age. It's well known that testosterone peaks in the 20s and slowly declines after that. And what is the effect of testosterone on the brain, on the mind? It makes one much more aggressive. The higher the testosterone, it makes you more violent, and it makes you much more interested in sex. It's been suggested by some U.S. generals that every man that goes into battle should have a testosterone patch put on his shoulder before he goes in, because he'll be a tougher, meaner soldier by doing that. I've thought a little bit clinically about testosterone, but The idea of masculinity in the Mormon faith is always been a little puzzling to me, and I'm taking off on this point that the view is a Victorian sort of a Victorian masculinity, expected to be chivalrous, polite, definitely the stronger sex, the woman is the weaker sex. There is no discussion in our culture about male sexuality. I never see it. It's just totally absent. Male sexuality is never discussed in, of course, in any of the formal church meetings. I mean, that would be highly inappropriate. But even informally, male sexuality is it's just absent, any dialogue about it. And I find that a little, you know, it's just like the previous session, the speaker was talking about the forbidden topics in Mormon fiction, and sex is number one, numero uno. You must not really talk about sex in any sort of explicit way. Or your work will just be completely banned and shunned. And in my view, there should be a place in Mormon fiction, maybe not to talk about sex in that larger umbrella of meaning, which also incorporates pornography, but to talk about sex in the sense of desire. What is male desire? Let's look at it that way. How does a man in a sort of buttoned up culture deal with his desires? And is there in this culture a greater incidence of repression, for example? Would Freud have a field day deconstructing the Mormon male mind nowadays if he were alive? I mean, he would really, I think, enjoy this very, very much. He'd be back in his Victorian era, and I look for the day when Mormon fiction can have a discussion about desire in a way that is, of course, not pornographic, but that really deals with it as a problem and as something beautiful at the same time, and to deal with it in a way that it's moving and a Mormon male could identify with. And I just don't see that very pervasive in our body of literature.
Could I turn your question back on you? You know some things because of your family history that I'm only guessing at. So your question about Mormon masculinity and maybe the fact that it doesn't get modeled for us by church leaders. I'm thinking about professional seminary teachers. I'm talking about religion professors at BYU. I'm thinking about that whole complex of ways that we say, okay, Joseph Smith, we got to deal with him.
Yeah.
But if you want somebody who was the Mormon masculine guy who wanted to sleep with all the women around him and evidently was able to, or Brigham Young, I mean, there's the most incredible backlash among the kinds of people I talked about, especially who then end up being role models. That is that part of what's raising your question?
Well, I think that what I was maybe suggesting or hoping you would address is, I think that that's part of why there is repression, is that it's a reaction to this historical life that the Mormons had in polygamy and Joseph Smith's activities and so forth. But, you know, in my own experience growing up in a professor of religion at BYU, was that sexuality had to come out somewhere, and it does. It always does. I mean, we've even had general authorities say that. I think even over the pulpit, you know. And so where does it come out for Mormon men, you know? And one of the things, you know, my father was very charismatic, and I think that he was a very sexual person in the pulpit, even, and I think that that was one place that it came out. But you know, what you do is, as a young man, you look at the Book of Mormon Arnold Freeberg pictures, and they are idealized men of powerful stature and arms as big as Montana, you know, and then you go to even the Boy Scout troop, and it's just like emasculating, the whole experience growing up. And I grew up with 10 sisters, so that was a double whammy. So anyway, you know, all of that to say is that sexuality has to go somewhere, and yet there's no mechanism for that. I lived in New York for 7 years, and coming back here, it was like girding up my loins, more literally. I mean, the men in Utah are so feminized compared to in the East, and part of that is Western, I think. But there's that swagger, there's that overt sexuality that I've experienced in New York City, which was really enervating, and I really miss that. That's pretty much all I'm saying, you know.
Paul has a wonderful poem which you ought to read. It's hard to have nipples in Utah.
Scott is doing variations on the poem. I think I like his variation almost better than the way it actually starts. Well, I do. Go ahead, sir.
I don't know that I speak for the group at all, but I have two observations. One, I happen to be a personal friend of Larry's and a neighbor and a great fan of his for many years. But I was impressed with the ability to take some themes and some subject matters that I have been exposed to and in a very brilliant way weave them into this compelling tale that is in that book. I just admire the skill. I don't know where it comes from or what the theme is. I was a German missionary as he was, and I identified with German culture in every page of the book. It was a barn burner for me. I admired the skill. Now, but secondly, I think it impressive that in such a work that we are opening the door to discussion of important matters that have always been swept under the rug or be no-no in the sense that several of you have referred to it. I think it's the beginning, I hope it is at least, of the ability and the willingness to address real world issues. These are issues around us in our own lives and in the paper daily and the trash that's thrown at us over television and so forth. And I see no reason that Latter-day Saints should be immune from coping with the same stuff the rest of humanity is. And again, I admired Larry's willingness and the skill that went into it. And my wife asked me, she read the book before I did even, and she wanted to know why, quote, did you like the book so much? She thought there must be some kind of ulterior motive or something behind it.
You and I agreed on something.
Which is pretty rare. But anyhow, I, in a sense, I guess what I'm doing is paying a tribute to you fellows for being willing to open the door a little bit to honest discussion of issues that should be addressed in the lives of all of us. And the fact that we're Mormons should not in any way discourage discourse or literature that addresses and involved with those kind of issues. Wonderful beginning, guys, and I hope we have a session like this on every future symposium.
Thank you, Don, and my accountants tell me the check's in the mail.
Let me mention, by the way, that Larry and I, during the hour that follows this presentation, will be among those signing books in the Harvest Room. There are books available there for those who are interested in following up on this. And a year from now, I want Scott's book to be in there. So we're working on that.
One thing that I wanted to say about this is that there wasn't a gripe, there wasn't any wheedling, griping sounding in any of your presentations. And I'm looking for literature in the Mormon area that is real gut-wrenching literature, that's really like the pirate stories I read as a child, or, you know, some real, I mean, I read all the time, and I read fiction a lot, and I read biographies a lot. I'm looking for the excitement of addressing the world in a way that I can't at home because I'm not getting that excitement. So I'm really glad to, you know there's somebody out there stirring up literary excitement that I think is coming out of our culture somewhat, sort of.
So I'm wondering if you're looking for a Mormon Johnny Depp.
Yes, you read my mind.
You know, I just wanted to quickly say, first of all, Larry, I went to Europe with Jenny, your daughter, years ago. But anyway, just wanted to say, I kind of laugh at this whole idea that male sexuality is the only thing that's repressed. I mean, sexuality in general, we're not talking about sexuality in general release society session. I mean, sexuality in general within the church is repressed because that's part of the fallen state of man, and it's something to be bridled, I think, and seen in a very negative terms. But in regards to that, Larry's comment, I just thought it would be interesting to note, I'm sure many of you know this, that in Utah, so many of our crime rates are lower than other states, but rape is one of those crimes where we are quite a bit higher than many states, and we're kind of at the top of the list for the nation, which I think might speak to where that repression is popping up in really negative, harmful areas in Utah. So just curious for your thoughts on that.
Oh, yes, there is repression about talking about sex. For fear, I mean repression in an LDS atmosphere, for fear that somehow that will make people more interested than they should be, I think. Which I think doesn't make a lot of sense, because how are we going to deal with it if we can't talk about it openly? And it's not just in the Mormon context. Talking about sex in a real way is hard for a whole bunch of people, and we might be some of those people sometimes. The poem was mentioned, so I'll read it to you. It's called Negative Space, which has a shape. You'll have to come up later and look at the shape. I can't walk it through the room for you. It's hard being Mormon and having nipples. Having hard nipples, knowing that they are there under clothing, under garments. One guy at ZCMI had the job, hard job, of sanding off every nipple of all the store's mannequins. Mormon mind regards nipples as purely negative space, including male nipples. Poor Tarzan's not-so-comic strip at the hands of an airbrush censor at the Des News left the Jungle King nippleless, defenseless, and yes, strangely emasculated during the mixed up 60s in the church newspaper's nervously neutered funnies. Well, so how do we get over, how do we get to a point where we can talk about sexuality in a real way and not feel like we're stepping on people's sensibilities or making our church brothers and sisters look askance at us?
Maybe it's more fun if they do look askance at us. Huh? Alex Caldera was once asked, how can you possibly live on the last street in Orem in Utah County? And he said, I'm looking for the hardest, most conservative place where people would react the strongest to what I do. This isn't nearly conservative enough. So maybe it's wonderful to be in a repressive society so that the things we say then titillate.
Mike sells books.
I'm sorry, Paul. You were asking a serious question.
And to some degree, that was a serious answer. I mean, literature does explore areas that somehow don't get touched otherwise. And, hopefully you won't have to read any of our future manuscripts inside a priesthood quorum manual so that people will think you're really paying attention to the important stuff.
much as I hate to change the subject from sex. I had someone once tell me that he thought that the reason why male participation at the Mormon Church is as high as it is because of the priesthood. A young male sociologist recently said to me that if they gave women the priesthood, the men would all stop coming to church. How much is someone else said a minute ago, it's not that men in the Mormon Church are that alpha male, hyper-masculine. You get into the priesthood and it's like you're part of a hierarchy and there's not a lot of striving for dominance there that I can see. Does the priesthood serve some kind of certifying function that makes up for what you have to give up otherwise as a man? Is that a question that makes any sense?
It makes every sense. You're probably, as far as I'm concerned, I'm probably the wrong person to answer it because I don't think exactly in those terms. I think the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints desperately needs female leadership along with male leadership. When people say, well, women are very satisfied to do what they do in the church and they don't really, you know, they're not power hungry. Well, Margaret Toscano addressed this in an earlier session this morning. But, it's not about power hunger. It's about we're an organization that supposedly is global and we are trying to reach all kinds of people and we only have one of the genders making decisions in the church. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I think that's an interesting question because I applaud the church preaching from the pulpit to men in general priesthood sessions, a doctrine that runs opposite to this masculinity that I was describing at the elk hunt. I mean, this sort of swagger. The church does preach that men should be kind. They should not elevate themselves. There's no role for verbal abuse, for sexual abuse, for physical violence in the home. I just think the church does a very, very good job of that. And it may be that in return for giving up that, they give the man the priesthood. So.
Well, I'm told we're out of time. The tape has run out. So you can swear freely, it won't get on the tape. No, I'm just kidding. So if you're interested in looking at ours and other books in the Harvest Room, we'll be in there shortly.